This is the, if my memory is right, this is the pulpit that I first used when I first came to this church in 2001, when my kids were 6 years old, 5 years old, and 3 years old. And I was in the last couple of months of my 20s back then. And I've learned a lot. And this church was so instrumental in raising my kids. My kids were well loved here at RBC, incredibly well loved here. I'm very thankful for this congregation, and thankful for your presence here. And I want to help you and encourage you. So this opening talk, we're going to start with really bad, depressing facts and truths, and if I follow the notes that I put together, I promise we'll end with a happy, little bit corny story about turtles. If you got the notes there, the four-point outline at the top, as far as our theme today is guiding with grace, and so as I considered that theme and these two scriptures, one from Ephesians 2 and one from Deuteronomy 6, these are the 4 points that kind of floated out of those texts and this topic to me. The task of raising kids is way, way too big and too difficult for a human solution. Therefore, we need grace. The second truth that floated out to me was that the parent, the mom or the dad, the married couple or the single dad or single mom who's raising these kids is way, way too needy. Needy is a nice way to put it. Way too messed up. Way too just completely, you know, out of control themselves. The parent who raises the kids is way too needy for human solutions. Therefore, we need grace. The third point is that the God who calls us is too loving to leave us without grace. His mercy is more. His mercy is more. And then the fourth point is that the gospel story of God's grace is too good to ever move past. So we are always, always, always guided by grace. Let's look together at Ephesians chapter 2 to begin with, and then we'll be back in Deuteronomy 6. Ephesians chapter 2, verses 1 through 3 says, "And you were dead in the trespasses and sins in which you once walked, following the course of this world, following the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience, among whom we all once lived in the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires of the body and the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, like the rest of mankind." That's Ephesians 2, 1 through 3. I was reading it from the ESV version, and I want to take a moment and pick those verses apart. Specifically, I like the translation here that I'm reading from the ESV. And then in the notes here, you've got these, how many is this? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, six statements: cultivated habits, social structure, spiritual relations, the body, the mind, the simple selfish nature. So I put kind of my labels there, but I want you to add to that where from the text these labels come from. So if we're reading from Ephesians 2, 1 through 3, and my first label, which is a label both for your kids and for you, is that we're going up against cultivated habits. And I take that from verse 1 says, "And you were dead in the trespasses and sins in which you once walked." I take that from the word walked. The biblical category of walking is the biblical category of having a habit, having a perpetual, continual way of life that is so, generally when you're walking, you're not thinking about walking. The only people who are thinking about walking are like high schoolers who are walking down a hall and they want to like look good, by the way, that they walk, you know, or whatever. But generally, you're just walking from one place to another. It's just a habit. You're just moving. So the first kind of spiritual problem that we're up against is cultivated habits. Second, I have their social structures. And if you see there, also in verse 1, it says, "in which you once walked, following the course of this world." That's social structures, following the course of this world. The course of this world, the social structures in this world, are not friendly to the parent who wants his or her son or daughter to end up like Jesus Christ. The social structures of this world are inimical to that process. They are not our friend. They are our enemy. And so the third thing is spiritual relations. So we go from social structures, to which are sort of big, visible ways that the world does things, to the inner spiritual relations. And if we're following here again from verse 2, in which you once walked, following the course of this world, following the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience. So the reason I think that's a fair way of understanding this text is spiritual relations equals the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that's now at work. This is the demonic powers. This is Satan himself. And so we have spiritual demonic activity waged against our kids and waged against us. But that's not enough, because then look again, verse 3, among whom we all once lived in the passions of our flesh, the inner desires of the body, the inner desires of the flesh. So if you see, that's the fourth one down. It's almost as if we could erase the second one, that the social structures would actually be good. I don't know, like we could live in Calvin's Geneva or some Amish, I don't know what, like colony where everybody was nice to each other. If we could fix the social structures, and even somehow if we could erase the demons out of the equation, the fourth one leaves us that, well, the flesh, the body, the hormones, the brain chemistry, both of you and of your kids, is working against this thing becoming successful. Even if you were in the right environment, the inner desires of your body are messed up. Now, that's not enough. Look at the fifth one, the inner desires of the mind, because look how it says, carrying out the desires of the body and the mind. So again, I would say, if somehow you could take your kids to the doctor and they could give them a shot that would fix their whatever it is, if they're older, their sexual urges, or if they're younger, just their temper or their anger or whatever it is, if they could somehow hormonally and chemically balance that out so that they wouldn't do that in their flesh, you still have the inner desires of the mind, which is working against us in this process. Then to cap it all off, the sinful, selfish nature. After he says all of that, carrying out the desires of the body and the mind, then he ends by saying, and we're by nature, children of wrath. And that word nature is way subterranean. It's the opposite of the frosting on the cake. Nature means it's completely baked into the cake. And to call it a cake means that by nature it's a cake. It's not like you could leave the gluten out, or you could leave the eggs out, or you could leave the sugar out. It's constituent of actually what it is, that by nature we're children of wrath. So that's you, and that's your kids. Point number one, the task of raising kids is too big for a human solution. We need grace. Point number two, the parent who raises the kids is too needy for human solutions. We need grace. I've been talking for just a couple of minutes to lay out those categories of sinfulness. So, here at this Saturday seminar, we're going to show you a better spanking technique, and like that's going to fix everything. Like we're going to work on the wrist action or something. Like, or we're going to show you a better talking technique. Like, we're going to show you how to dialogue with your kids, and if you say things this way, it's going to fix it. This problem is way, way, way worse than anything that could possibly be fixed with the right methodology or the right conversation. Your children need more than you can give them. That's the point that I'm trying to make. Your children need more than you can give them. You cannot save your children. You're not able to do that. You are not accountable before God to do for your children what you cannot do for your children. You can teach your children. You're accountable to do that. You can personally plead at heaven's throne for your children, and arguably you're accountable to do that. You can model by your life the things that you teach your children, and you are accountable to do that. But you can't change your children's nature, and you can't fix the inner desires of their body and of their mind, and you're certainly not going to change the social structures within which your children grow up in, though you try to protect them from that as you're able. Your children need more than you can give them. That's why we get to point number three. The God who calls us is too loving to leave us without grace. Ephesians 2, verse 4. But God, being rich in mercy. I just heard somebody say, actually this morning while I was having my quiet time, I heard somebody say, God's love is not a proportional therefore. God's love is an extravagant nevertheless. That's awesome. God's love is not a proportional therefore. God's love is an extravagant nevertheless. That's grace. because after verses 1 through 3, when it says, but God, it's not, okay, we did everything good, therefore God loved us. God's love is a nevertheless extravagance. It says, but God, being rich in mercy because of the great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in our trespasses, made us alive together with him. By grace you have been saved and raised us up with him and seated us with him in the heavenly places in Christ Jesus, so that in the coming ages he might show the immeasurable riches of his grace in kindness toward us in Christ Jesus. For by grace you've been saved through faith. This is not your own doing. It is the gift of God, lest anyone should boast. God's love is not a proportional therefore. God's love is an extravagant nevertheless. And that leads us to understand that we're saved by God's mercy. We're saved by God's grace. The way that it says it here, God, it's God's mercy. It's God's great love. God made us alive. God raised us up. And just to be technically theological for a minute, and I'll show you how important this is in parenting, we are saved by grace through faith. We're not saved for faith. If you were saved for faith, or in that sense, if you were saved by your faith, God would have this thing called salvation, and he'd kind of be stroking his chin. And then once you had enough faith, then God would give you salvation as a transaction for your faith. That's not what this is saying. We're saved by God's grace through faith. We're not saved for faith like we have enough faith to put a coin in the machine and then we get salvation. We're saved by God's grace. The reason that's important, specifically for parenting, is because in all of the seminars that we cover today, like spanking and obedience and all of that, there is definitely a conditionality to behavior, and there's a consequence to behavior, and you teach your kids that. There's conditions and behaviors, and you're like, if you do this, this will happen. If you do this, that'll happen. But we have to be able to discipline and inculcate morality and standards of behavior without making our littles actually start to feel like they're going to be saved for their faith. Like if they perform enough faith for God, then God will give them salvation. It's not transactional. It's a completely free, uninfluenced gift. That's what Ephesians 2, 8, 9, that has to be what it means. That is, by grace we've been saved through faith, and that's not our own doing. It's the gift of God. It's not a result of works. So if we're going to be guided by grace in parenting, the first thing that would mean is that those six things, the cultivated habits, the social structures, the spiritual relations, the inner desires of the body, the inner desires of the mind, and the sinful, selfish nature. If we're going to be guided by grace in parenting, the first thing to remember is that, it's kind of my point two on the top points, that I need to be honest about my own sin and the reality of how deeply ingrained my sinful nature is. So I have to be honest about that in my own life. If you're married, be honest about that in your own marriage. And then be honest about that in your relationship with the church, that you're willing to get help and be accountable and be open and honest about parenting. So from Ephesians 2, let's head over to Deuteronomy 6. We'll make a couple of more points about guiding our children by grace in parenting. Deuteronomy 6. This has already come up. I'm the first teacher, I suppose, in this conference, but this has already been quoted from up here once or twice already. Deuteronomy 6 says, "Now this is the commandment, the statutes and the rules that the Lord your God commanded me to teach you, that you may do them in the land to which you are going over to possess it, that you may fear the Lord your God, you and your son and your son's son, by keeping all his statutes and his commandments, which I command you all the days of your life, that your days may be long. Hear therefore, O Israel, and be careful to do them, that it may go well with you, that you may multiply greatly as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you in a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." So, big picture here from Deuteronomy 6, this would be a goofy way to take this text. A goofy way to take this text would be to lay out that paragraph and everything he says about going on the way and on your doorposts. The goofy way to take this text would be to get like a poster board and write out like, well, when I'm here, I'm going to talk to my kids about God's grace. And when we're in the doorway of my house, I'm going to talk to my kids about God's grace. Like, as if he's listing 12, not 11, not 13, but 12 places that you have to talk to your kids about God's grace. This text has one interpretation. And it's the inescapable observation that there is no time, nor is there any place where you are not raising your kids in God's grace. There's no time, nor is there any place where you are not actively discipling your kids. There's no place where you're not supposed to be an example to your kids. There's no topic that cannot be turned into a teaching opportunity with your kids. There's no room in your house. There's no place outside your house. There's no subject, no theme where you're not discipling your kids. So, back to Ephesians 2. The prince of the power of the air, the social structures of the world, the desires of the flesh and of the mind. The point I was trying to make there was there is no place where sin is not operative. Not inside, not outside, not in public school, not in homeschool, any environment, sin is going to be there. Sin is everywhere. Well, so what Deuteronomy 6 is saying is that the positive kind of embodied virtue of walking with the Lord should be present everywhere. So that's what this is saying. And what this requires is that you're present with your kids in the moment and you're watching what they're learning and you're there with them. And not only that you're present with them, but that, if I could use the word present and presentation, you're present with them. And then while you're present with them, that is, you're engaged with them, you're not staring at your phone, you're staring at your kids, like you're present with them. And then you have a presentation of, well, look at what God says about this, or look at the reaction to that. Just like in the Proverbs where he says to his son, you see that harlot over there, you see that poor man over there, you see that uncultivated field over there, that family is going to be hungry. So you're present, and you're always able to make a presentation about God, his grace, his truth. And I know that's very simple, but I just want to tell you, I believe that that's increasingly rare for me to see a young mom who's really present with her kids is becoming increasingly rare in my observations, which are limited. And then to have a young dad who is not only present with his kids, but also ready to make a presentation about God's grace and God's truth. Because it's just so easy to get distracted. In God's providence, he prepared me for today because my grandson's here. And so yesterday, Carly and Amy were gone all day. They stayed in Illinois two nights ago. So my son-in-law wakes up and says, I got a lot of homework. Would you mind if I left and went to a coffee shop and studied all day? I was like, that's fine. So at 8 a.m., my 21-month-old woke up, and my son-in-law, who I love, he didn't get back till 5 p.m. I thought he had to do like an hour worth of homework. Like, so from 8 a.m. until 5 p.m., I have this 21-month-old, you know? Like, so here I am, like, prepared to say, none of you are present enough with your kids. And, you know, and I'm like, I know why. Like, it was insane. Like, they came home, and then I was like, oh, like, I'm a big reader. I love, you know, so I was like, I've been just doing this all day. I'm going to go, you know, finally get some reading done. So I go in to read at, like, 6 o'clock. I'm like, I developed ADD. I can't read one paragraph. I'm like, where's Netflix? Like, my brain was just like scrambled eggs. You know what I mean? It was nuts. But I'm just saying, what Deuteronomy 6 is saying is that you need to be present with your children, and whatever's happening, you need to be so alive to God's grace that you're able to make a non-cheesy presentation about God's grace based on whatever's happening. The upshot here is simply this: you are discipling your children. Back to my rant about looking at your phone. If you really are looking at your phone too much and you're not paying attention to your children, you are discipling your children by doing that. You are. Deuteronomy 6 is saying you are discipling your children. Not you should disciple your children. It's saying you are discipling your children. You already are. You may be discipling them in the wrong way. You may be discipling them hypocritically and poorly. You may 5 years from now regret the way you discipled them, but you are discipling them here and now. They are making assessments about what's important and what matters by watching you, by your presence, by your unconsidered comments about things by your neglect, by your anger, by your excuse making, by whatever it is. I know that's hard to take, but that's reality. That's reality. There's never a time when you're not discipling your children. This is why we have to swim in God's grace. It's God's grace is a must. That's why this is so important. You're always discipling your children. And it's possible, sadly, it's way too possible to, you know, say something true to your children on Sunday at church and then contradict it by the way you live Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. We've all done that. So we have a wonderful crosswalk ministry here for kids. We've got youth ministry. Wonderful. There have been times when a crosswalk teacher, maybe, or a youth leader, there was some problem or even sin in their life, and we had to ask that crosswalk leader or that youth leader to step aside from leadership because they're not setting the right example for those they're leading. As church elders, we've done that from time to time. There have been so many times when, if I could have, I would have done that to moms and dads, but I can't. I can't set you aside. Like, you know, I'm not saying I'm out to get you, but I'm just saying we don't do that in the family. But the same principles are operative, where you are so aggressively and actively, it's almost an oxymoron, you're aggressively and actively undoing biblical teaching by your neglect that, you know, it seems to be doing more harm than good. So where we want to get to, of course, is that what we teach is backed up by the way that we walk, the way that we live, the way we're present with them, and what we present to them out of our heart and out of our mouth. And I'm just saying, being present with them is harder than you think it is. I know that. And having a genuine presentation about God's grace, no matter if we're in the house, in the kitchen, in the living room, at Walmart, wherever we are, that's hard because it takes you being very, very aware of God's grace in your life. And the number of parents who are really filled with God's grace so that they're always ready to share it, it should be greater than it is. Now let's keep going in Deuteronomy, verses 10 through 15. And when the Lord your God brings you into the land that he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob to give you, with great good cities that you did not build, and houses full of good things that you did not fill, and cisterns that you did not dig, and vineyards and olive trees that you did not plant, and when you eat and are full, and then take care lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. It is the Lord your God you shall fear. Him you shall serve, and by his name you shall swear. You shall not go after other gods as the gods of the people who are around you. For the Lord your God in your midst is a jealous God, lest the anger of the Lord your God be kindled against you, and he destroy you from off the face of the earth. And I think you can see there in the notes, I put kind of three categories that are addressed there in verses 10 through 15. The danger of forgetting God because of affluence, the danger of abandoning God because of surrounding idolatries, and the danger of doubting God because of hardship. The first thing that he addresses is that affluence. Your house is full of good things and you have everything you want, so you can forget God. But the second way to forget God is verse 14, to go after other gods, the gods of the people around you. And, you know, what also happens so often is the danger of doubting God because of hardship. When whatever we were praying for doesn't get answered, and that hardship makes us sort of quit trusting God and turn away. But what he begins with in verse 12 is he says, then take care lest you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. I think that's the grace of gratitude. Remember that God brought you out, and that you used to be a slave, everything there in Ephesians 2. You used to have those cultivated habits, social structure, spiritual relations, your body, your flesh, your nature, and God freed you from that slavery through the cross of Jesus Christ. I think thankfulness for salvation is so wonderful. And then I think being able to resist the idolatries around us, everybody wants to know how to do that. In our world, LGBTQ, all the stuff that's happening, how do we protect our kids from going after those idolatries? That's what this is talking about. What the parents have done in verses 1 through 9 kind of helps with that process, but really the engine that drives it is remembering the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. It's this constant attitude of worship. Now let me take you through 16 through 25 because there's something surprising here, and this will be the last text that we read. You shall not put the Lord your God to the test as you tested him at Massah. You shall diligently keep the commandments of the Lord your God and his testimonies and his statutes which he commanded you, and you shall do what is right and good in the sight of the Lord, that it may go well with you, that you may go in and take possession of the good land that the Lord swore to give to your fathers by thrusting out all your enemies from before you as the Lord promised. When your son asks you in time to come, What is the meaning of the testimonies and the statutes and the rules that the Lord our God has commanded you? That's a great question. When your son asks you in time to come, what is the meaning of the testimonies and the statutes and the rules that the Lord your God has commanded you? Then you shall say to your son, we were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. You see what's surprising there? And the Lord showed signs and wonders, great and grievous against Egypt and against Pharaoh and all his household before our eyes. And he brought us out from there. And the Lord commanded us to do all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always, that we might preserve us alive, that he might preserve us alive as we are to this day. And it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to do all his commandments before the Lord our God as he has commanded us. The point here is that the kid asks a question in verse 10 about testimonies, statutes, and rules and commandments. The point here, the surprising thing here, is that the son asks a question about laws, commandments, and moral behaviors. And the answer to that question about commandments is the story of salvation. That's what surprises me about this text. It reminds me a little bit of Jesus. You try to find in vain a place in the Gospels where somebody asks Jesus a question and he's like, yes, that's a good question, and he precisely answers their question. He never answers their question. The kid's like, tell me about the commandments. And the parents are like, let me tell you a story. Man, these hands were calloused from making bricks with less and less straw. And Pharaoh was like, imagine a dragon. Imagine like the worst thing ever. There was no way that we could conquer this. And let me tell you what, God took Pharaoh down. They tell the story of their salvation. What Deuteronomy 6, 1 through 9 is saying is that as you are present with your kids at home, in the street, on the phone, wherever, you should be representing to them in 1,000 ways the story of salvation. The son asks a question about the commandments, and the answer to the question is the story of Jesus and his love. As I diagrammed out the text, the question comes in verse 20. I counted 5 clauses in verse 21, 22, 23, and 24 before finally the parent gets around to saying something about commandments and statutes in verse 24. As soon as the son says law, what the parent ends up saying about the law in verse 24 is that God gave us these statutes, you see that? For our good. For our good. A mom who has a depth understanding of the law of God is able to explain to her daughter why the law of God is for our good. This is a beautiful part of parenting, and the better you can get at that, you know, the closer the sweet spot you're going to get, that God's commands are for our good. And if you really believe that, if you really believe that the commandments of God are for your good, then you will no longer walk in a hypocritical way where we're going to have to say, you know, to your kids, well, they may have said the right thing, but they didn't do the right thing. The parent who actually believes that following God's law is for her good is the parent who actually follows the law of God, you know, because this is what drives us, this understanding that God loves us. Demonstrate the goodness of the law of God in your own life, and demonstrate the sweetness of the law of God in your own disposition. I just love to reflect this story of God's salvation as often as we can with our kids. So I want to if you want to become a better parent, try to cultivate these 3 things. I didn't put them in the notes, but I just wrote them down. And I didn't have a pen, so I asked AJ Anderson for a pen, so she gets half credit for these 3 points because I wrote them down with the pen that she gave me. Number 1, awareness of God's goodness. Awareness of God's goodness. Number 2, gratitude for God's grace. Number 3, eager expression of thanks and praise. Number 1, awareness of God's goodness. Awareness of God's goodness. Number 2, gratitude for God's grace. Number 3, eager expressions of thanks and praise. That's what I find when the kid asks, what about this law and what about that law? Then in verse 21, he goes, we were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt, but the Lord brought us out. Awareness of God's goodness, gratitude for God's grace, and eager expressions of thanks and praise. And I put them in that order because that first one, awareness of God's goodness, all that is awareness. All I'm asking you to do is notice something. Just see it. That's where it starts. Notice it and see it. The second one, gratitude for God's grace, is of course taking that in, and it makes a difference in your own heart. So first is just seeing it. That's external. Third, or second, is taking it in, and it produces gratitude in your heart. And then you see how this leads us logically to that third step, eager expressions of praise and thanks. Because once we see it and take it in, then the only response to that is worship and gratitude. So when the parent answered in verse 21, "We were Pharaoh's slaves, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, and the Lord showed us signs and wonders, and he brought us out that he might give us this for our good." This was a parent who was aware of God's goodness, who was so grateful for God's grace that I got to believe that this was being expressed with joy and thanksgiving. So that's what I'm saying. I guess the most important part of parenting is if you would become a person who would never tire of telling the great, great story of Jesus and his love. To be a person who refuses to doubt God's goodness, even when the cancer doesn't go away, when the money doesn't come in, when the prayer request is not added with or responded to with an immediate yes, to still trust God's goodness and his love. This is what this is calling us to when you put this whole chapter together. You just be a person who is so insanely thankful for God's goodness and God's love. Sometimes you ever just dream, what would it be like for your kids to turn 20 and to talk to their friends? And your 20-year-old son or daughter's friends, like, "Yeah, my mom's just, people have mistreated her and she's bitter." And your kid's other 20-year-old friend says, "Yeah, my dad was just always harsh with me and he's always stressed out about money." What would it be like for your 20-year-old to say, "I can't ever imagine my mom being bitter. My mom was so overwhelmed that Jesus would love a woman like her that I can't ever imagine my mom being bitter." What would it be like for your 20-year-old whose friend said, "You know, my dad was always stressed out and he was short-tempered"? What would it be like for your 20-year-old son to say, "I can't imagine my dad being short-tempered with me. My dad was so close to Jesus that he was strict at times, but that strictness, I never doubted that it was for my good. And that it was out of his love for me, not his annoyance with me." Like, I know we're never going to get there yet because none of us are Jesus. But you can get closer than you are by repenting, by cultivating these three points, really. Awareness of God's goodness, gratitude for God's grace, and eagerness to express praise and thanksgiving. So that just leaves us with one happy, corny story about some turtles. When I was preparing for this lecture to the thousands who I knew would be present today, I studied up at Drexel Town Square because that's where the good coffee shop is, and the $2 tacos at the Mexican place. And so when I was done studying, there's like a wetlands path behind there, like a nature trail. And so I took a walk. I walked through that thing two times. It was a really nice day. And I just prayed. I didn't put in my earbuds and listen to anything. I just did a prayer walk. I'm like, I'm never... How can I say this without having you feel bad for me? When I get up to teach about parenting, I'm never in a position like, got this thing nailed. You know what I mean? Like, what am I doing up here? So I'm just praying for my kids, not all of whom are born again yet, and not all of whom are living a moral, safe life. And so I'm walking through this path praying. And I'm, you know, growing anxious about my kids, and, you know, there's a kind of prayer where you let go of your anxieties and Jesus takes them. There's another kind of prayer where you just pray about your anxieties and they become more and more real to you as you pray about them. And it's sort of like counterintuitive. It's like taking headache medicine when you have a headache that gives you a worse headache. Like, what is this? Side effect of Excedrin, more headaches. Like, it shouldn't work that way. But anyway, so I'm praying for my kids and I'm feeling anxious. And I'm like, I'm looking at the birds, you know, and walking through the path. I'm like, Jesus, I know that one of the things you said is don't worry about anything because you take care of every bird, and, you know. So I'm walking, I'm praying, and then, you know, I see in the water two adult turtles and four baby turtles. And to me, that's Carly, Sam, Riley, and Andrew, my son-in-law, who is a son to me. So there's these two grown-up turtles and these four baby turtles. And so I take out my camera, and I took a picture of it, you know, and I sent it to my kids, and they start texting me back, "Dad, why do you always look at turtles?" You know, and I said, "Well, this reminds me of our family." And Carly texts back right away, oh, Dad, you're making me cry." And then she texts, "Everything's making me cry because I'm pregnant." Like, she's crying a lot. But of those 3 points that I'm giving you, awareness of God's goodness, gratitude for God's grace, eager expression of praise and thanks, all I'm saying is, you know, forgive me for saying that in this illustration, I'm the one that got it right. But all I'm saying is, at least in that moment of my life, when I saw those turtles, that's what was happening in my life. I was aware of God's goodness. I was grateful for God's grace. Even though I haven't seen God's grace do everything I want to see it do, I'm grateful for what I have seen, and I trust him for the rest of it. And I'm eager to express praise and thanks to God, knowing that he has the sparrow, he has the turtles, and that he has my family. So the last thing that I or anybody else who's teaching today wants to leave you with is this kind of white knuckle. If I don't follow all these rules, my kids are gonna die. What I wanna leave you with is the one rule you have to follow is be a person who is always ready to bust out the greatest story in the world of Jesus and his love. Because, you know, at the end of the day, that's all we got. Let me pray. Heavenly Father, I thank you again for these people who have gathered together this day. And I pray, Lord, that we would answer our children's questions with the story of Jesus and his love. 'Tis so sweet to trust in Jesus. Just by faith, the plunge beneath his cleansing blood. Lord, give us that focus so that as we walk along the way, as we discipline, as we exhort and teach, it's always from your goodness and the love of Jesus. In his name we pray. Amen.